Hello everyone, Barney here. Welcome to Loco Ludus and to the second special episode dedicated to Trickster's Net. That means that I'm joined by Tom Burmeister, who is my chief collaborator on the project. And for those who don't know, Trickster's Net is an international role-playing game design exchange project for young people in Kempton, Germany, where I am, and across Wales, where Tom is. And in this episode, we are joined by our illustrator, Maximilian Hartley, who really has been like a third collaborator in this kind of foundational setup. And in the discussion that you're going to hear, we talk about that. We talk about Max's work. We talk about his involvement in the project and the process that the three of us went through getting Trickster's Net ready, preparing Trickster's Net conceptually and visually, thanks to Max's work. And the work really is stunning. I'm sure that some listeners might have come across it either on Facebook or on Twitter. But I guess the wider public will be able to see more of it when we finally publish Trickster's Net digitally in the winter. So Max's work will be more widely available then. But we've been posting it as much as we can and as often as well, as appropriate, perhaps I should say. The other thing to just mention again is that Tom and I are the facilitators of this project, which the young people who are involved in it in Germany and in Wales are taking on. We are all working on it. We're all the co-authors of Trickster's Net. So it's kind of difficult really to clearly articulate that it's mine and Tom's project, or that it's mine and Tom's and Max's project, because really it's not. Ultimately it's a project for everyone who is involved, and the hope, the aspiration at all points is to give everyone as much involvement and acknowledgement as possible. And I think more of that will come in due course. One really nice thing is that here in Kempton we have a games convention called Gamesvention, which is really nice, and we've been allowed to take over a room and run three sessions of Trickster's Net, which will be GM'd by some of the German participants here. And that's on the 18th of September. So that's really exciting. It's really exciting to have the opportunity to put the game out in a public space, face-to-face, with the participants, and see what kind of response we get to that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. The young people who are involved are fantastic. We've got such a range of different characters, a real range of different gaming experience, but, everyone is everyone is stuck, gets stuck into the spirit of the thing. So that's wonderful. This conversation that you're going to hear between Tom and Max and myself is pretty loose and freewheeling. I think it's a little bit speculative at times. And I do think it's thought provoking and illuminating with regard to the process that we went through in developing this project. If anyone out there has any thoughts or responses they'd like to make, please do leave me an audio message on Anchor or email me at locoludus@gmail.com or find me on Facebook under Locoludus or on Twitter at @loco_ludus. Can I even say it properly? Loco_ludus. If my voice in this conversation sounds a little rough and ready, it's because I was sitting in a half-renovated room, which fortunately now is not being renovated anymore. So that was that. But it's fine. It's totally fine. So I hope you enjoy our conversation and I wish you all the best. See you. Hi, Tom and Max. It's very nice to have this chance to talk Trickster's Net with you both more again.
Yes.
So last episode, assuming this is the second episode, I introduced you, Tom, and we talked, you know, I introduced the topic. We talked about the progression of that. And so to have Max on today just adds to that. It's like a snowballing effect because, Max, you are our wonderful artist, our illustrator for the project. And and I just wanted to start by saying that whenever we, you know, disseminate the images and promote the project, you know, everyone loves the pictures, almost as much as we love the pictures.
I love the pictures. I'm a big fan of the pictures.
Like we did last time, we talked about the history and the prehistory of the project. So I wonder, I wonder if we could follow that same kind of format. Max, what do you think of as being the prehistory of getting involved with Trickster's Net?
That comes from how I met you, really. And I remember when I was a student at the time and you were a visiting lecturer and you had this project you wanted to do with a giant zoetrope project. And you asked people to do sort of pictures for it, and I did this sort of 50 frame animated zoetrope thing, and I really liked what I made. I was like a big fan of my own work, and then I don't think that project went ahead, and I always thought, oh, the work was so good though that I did, that if there's ever another chance to work with Barney, I will do it, you know, like I'll just say yes. And then I remember I got this strange they got this cryptic sort of text from you that said I might need some art for some sort of tabletop role play games. And I said, oh, what kind? And you were like really classy ones. And I was in. Oh, that was when I knew. I was like, oh, I'm in. Yeah, that was enough.
Yeah, classy's about right. That's good, yeah.
Yeah. I suppose the bit that I, you know, maybe the first question should have been, Max, how would you describe yourself or your practice for people who don't know you?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I'm a sort of a practicing artist, I suppose. But my background's in animation and illustration and moving image. So it's like animation, sort of the intersection of my two interests, which is like drawing pretty pictures and watching movies, you know. So that's where I come from, yeah. And it's like, and I've got like quite a lot of, I mean, I was into Trickster's Net because I'm really into like archaic lore and mythology.
As you've said, I was a lecturer, and I've actually kind of taught you at two different places, haven't I? So our friendship goes back a long time, and I remember seeing your student film and just thinking it was just amazing, dazzling. Like, it's one, you know, you don't try not to use dazzling too much, but that is it. And all these, because I love flickery stuff, and you've got all of that flickery stuff going. And even what I think is so interesting about your work is that you're largely, or have been, a digital artist, but you really bring this kind of analog craft aspect to it. So the images are always so rich structurally, and then they're also really rich thematically, you know, and that will come on to the symbolism and all of that kind of stuff later. And yeah, I contacted you, didn't I, to see if you might be interested in working on something. And then I kind of asked you if you'd be interested in working on something else, because maybe someone else wouldn't be able to illustrate it, and that wasn't working. And then me and Tom were furiously putting this application together for Trickster's Net, and all of a sudden it was, I thought, right, okay. And Tom and I talked, got in touch with you, and I remember then we had a little chat, very brief chat, about this rough world.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was trying to, like, you know, I always think the longer I have to sort of delve into basically world building, like, my images are very heavily based on, like, research. They're not, I mean, it's sort of the pictures themselves are quite intuitive, like, they just sort of arrive, but that works a lot better if I've got a huge background of, like, research and knowledge. So, yeah, definitely right from the first conversation, I was like, well, what is it? What's the trickster? What? You know, I was sort of pushing you, but it was quite a brief conversation, and you were like, oh, yeah, no, we'll get to that. I just, you know, it's sort of this. I'm, you know,
it did.
The first thing you said, you were like, oh, I'm thinking about this plow in going through the sky and like a net. And that was maybe all there was to it. And I remember thinking, oh, I kind of get this. Like, how loose this is suits me, because yeah, there's a lot to build from.
There's a lot of the geometric lines and stuff seem to be part of that initial brief. Just like, okay, yeah, it's all about geometry in the boundaries between space. It's really good. I mean, like, I always thought, like Barney said, that when I first saw your work, it was like, hey, yeah, this does cross that boundary between digital and it's got that practical edge to it, which is something I've always been interested in, kind of like, where you can't tell, is that done on a computer or has he done that with wood blocks? I can't actually tell. And that's, I think, what you're going for. I think this is wonderful, wonderful work.
I mean, it's just a natural. Yeah, no, I think that I can't avoid it, is the thing, because the way I learned how to use the technology is so, basically, so rudimentary, because I taught myself. It's like, the process I use imitates screen printing anyway, so I can't, there'd be no reason to try and avoid that.
So one of the concepts that we're all involved with in this is being this online exchange between Wales and Germany, that the exchange is based around cultural exchange. And as we've talked about this, on the one hand, these differences that we might have between Germany and Wales, but then also those commonalities and that going back to, you know, ancient times, to, you know, shared mythologies and things like that. And yeah, I know that's something that both of you could certainly talk a good lot about.
I can give an example just now that the session I just had ended with a dragon fighting a dragon slayer. And that was obviously you would think, well, that is that the Welsh side, because obviously, you know, our story is about it. No, it's the German side. So there's a definitely like a, I think it was Siegfried the Dragon Slayer. So it was all very similar. It's like, great, we could echo that using Welsh mythology and interesting things. But yeah, that's one example. That was just
there's quite a lot of good overlaps, yeah. And I think the Siegfried or Sigurd, yeah, that saga, the what are they are, the Volsung saga in Norse, but it's the same. And then it, so they've got the dragon, right? But they've also got Odin. And then in Celtic Britain, you'd get sort of the Wodan character, who's the same, which you know, sort of pointed out, Tom, was like the Wild Hunt character. Hmm. And in the dragon slaying one, in the Siegfried and the dragon one, he's like the instigator in them getting the magic sword. I think it's the father of Siegfried. Odin sticks it into the big tree and is like, whoever can pull the sword out of the big tree, he's like in charge. It's like King Arthur. But that's like, so the King Arthur, there's a lot in the German story of Siegfried that mirrors a lot of the Welsh mythologies that are more broken up. So that's fun.
And one other thing that we should talk about is our exchanges. But I remember Tom reminded me of this, that you, Max, I think I'm remembering anyway, that there's the Wild Hunt going on, and then it kind of jumps into Father Christmas.
Yeah, that was sort of a parallel I was surprised that less people had made. I mean, I think we talked about it a bit, me and Tom, that you've got the winter solstice, Yuletide, you've got this sort of pagan festival across all of Europe, really. And then, you know, which in the Germanic religions involves, usually Odin or Wodan or whoever, but it sometimes other characters leading this wild hunt across the sky. And it takes place, that one of the major times of celebrating that is Yuletide. And so it seems weird that we still have, you can still look up and see sort of like a sleigh and a charge of reindeer in the sky. And it's just like, instead of collecting heads, he's giving out presents these days. But I thought that was quite interesting.
I started looking into that a little bit. And there are some people that, you know, do make that connection between Father Christmas. Yep. And because what, you know, Odin's got this eight-legged,
it's got a lot of legs.
Deer or some? Is it a horse or a deer?
It's a big horse. Yeah. But no, yeah, that's right. Lots of hooves. You'd hear them on the rooftops, right? It's the same deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's interesting. I think there's a lot. I remember. When I was studying in Wales, I got really interested in all the Wagner stuff, you know, like what's he called? Ludwig II, or the big castle, Neuschwanstein, and all those castles. And I got really into those.
So if you come and visit, what? Max,
the castles,
we can go and visit there.
The castles of Bad King Ludwig.
I definitely will, yeah. No, and I, yeah, and I remember looking at the books of that, and I really into it while I was living in Cardiff, and there was this little, there's an Austrian cafe I used to go to and sort of pretend I was in Germany. And then I started going around all the castles, like Cardiff Castle and Castle Koch up in the hills. And they're really painted and ornate as well. And I sort of, in my mind, drew this parallel between the German sort of ornate castles and these little Welsh ones. Well, Cardiff Castle's reasonably large.
I think the more modernist bits, I thought
it was quite a nice sort of painted correlation. Yeah. Sort of the fairy tale, the intentional fairy tale aspects of both those castles that are more like follies, really. Hmm. I think that is quite interesting as well. And a lot of my work for this project was definitely inspired by that idea of like the 1900s idea of mythology, which both these places sort of exhibit in their architecture.
Yeah, it's good. And it's totally where so much of our kind of the things we take for granted of myths and legends comes from, that kind of 19th century renaissance of those ideas, of the kind of romanticization of those myths, you know, from Robin Hood to King Arthur, and that's the birth of fantasy, right? And in a way, that's, you could argue, it's not completely, but it's within scope of the birth of some tabletop role-playing and board games. Because you've got, like, H.G. Wells' Little Wars coming out at the end of that century. Like, and I know that's wargaming, but it's in that same space of, like, fantastically recreating stuff. And I always think that... I personally go to Tolkien when I think of, like, one of the most emblematic story moments in history of the Riddles in the Dark. It's not Riddles in the Dark, sorry. The one where they're... The one, Bridge of Khazad Dûm and... Journey in the Dark, where they're going through Moria, and actually that captured so many minds as a kind of narrative moment that within 10 years they're recreating it around the tabletop using dice and rules and stuff that have maybe come from that 19th century Little Wars kind of gaming thing. So I think that what I'm saying, I suppose, is the links between gaming becoming more formalized as a kind of a whole space to exist in, and fantasy, like, as a kind of narrative area, maybe come from a very similar place in human history.
I think so. I mean, I think for both, and it's a tricky subject area, some of this, but I think for both Wales and Germany, the commonality that they shared in the sort of early 1900s sort of art and Renaissance of folk culture was sort of an attempt to define themselves. For Germany, obviously, they'd just become a united country, and they were trying to, with Grimm's fairy tales and all those lovely illustrations, they're trying to prove on a world stage that they are as credible in Europe as, say, like France or Italy as cultural hubs. And then Wales, it sort of to define itself against England, really, yeah, being like, no, we've got our own culture and our own fairy stories. And that upholding of folk traditions is rich in both countries, richer than it is in England, certainly, of being like, no, this say a lot about us. And then, yeah, in the ancient times, the Bronze Age and stuff, the migration period, that's where they have real commonality. And I think both of those things I held in my head while we were discussing it, because those are my two real reference points for the, you know, the link.
I think with the 19th century, what's interesting as well, I mean, there's so many things that come out of that century, because on the one hand, it's kind of future facing, you know, so many things that we still have now are kind of begun or defined in that period of time, but also, you know, really fundamentally, you've got that awareness of the past, this uneven and quite rapid recognition of prehistory.
It may be a bit of a fantasy, though. I would say, like often, there's a lot of fantasization of that era of like, oh, there was a time when we didn't have to worry about politics and inequality and poor people. There was this wonderful, fantastical time in the back. And can we go back to that? Like, the folk movement had that in the 19th century, and it's a little bit of a... foretelling, like, kind of fantasticalness. But I think there's a positive side to it also, which is the creation of fantasy as a place to inhabit as a kind of narrative enjoyment. But it's there's also a weird kind of political edge to it, which is to be wary of, certainly. So
the thing I wanted to say there is that I think that understanding of the past begun through that process is refiltered through these different modernizing ideas, you know, these contemporary ideas. And I mean, you're picking out another, you know, another aspect of that. Totally. Max, did you want to add something there?
No, I mean, I think I think that's sort of, those were my touchstones before I knew anything about, say, the trickster or the project. When I just knew it was about these two sort of locations, and having never been to Germany, having to sort of rely on my own fantasy version of it that I invented while I was in Wales, which is quite nice, and being like, oh, it's sort of blue and gold and the banners in the wind, and, you know, I sort of imagine these castles and stuff. So that really is all I've got to say on it. I just, you know, that, yeah.
Well,
and then
can we talk about the way our initial burst of exchange and the development of your pictures before the project started, because I mean, just to mention, when Max and I had this quick conversation, and he's going, what is this, what is that, tell me about this, I want to start thinking about it, I think before I'd taken two steps back home, I was outside in the sun. Max was sending me pictures of, like, reference pictures or some of his own pictures that came to mind. So Max kind of started then, you know, it was...
Yeah, quite hardcore, like, here's all these references, here's all these old pictures, and... I wanted to jump in, like, I sort of know how I work, and if I can excite myself, that'll keep me running for quite a long time, you know. So that was the goal. And yeah, definitely, I entered into it sort of knowing what I wanted out of it, you know, for myself, selfishly, which is that I hadn't really done any drawing, any meaningful illustration work in about 5 years. I'd sort of stopped that in order to pursue sort of filmmaking projects. And I wanted to redefine the language I was using. And I had these sort of ideas I wanted to use of sort of multiple eyes and sort of symbolism, images hidden within images, mirroring sort of Celtic knotwork. I already had that idea before the project. And so it lined up nicely. And yeah, I started sending you things, pictures I drew on paper in ink that were very crude. Do you remember? There's like, they're just sort of black shapes. And I remember thinking, I'm going to think I don't know what I'm doing because these just look terrible. Because they're so crude. But I knew I needed to start at sort of ground zero on it and work my way up. So I wanted to just start with the crudest, almost like cave painting forms. My worry was that you might suddenly be like, oh my God, he doesn't know what he's doing. So that was my hesitation. This is before the channel existed. This is just, I mean, I can send you the pictures. They're very crude.
Because I remember the one with the guy, paper, with the person. I don't know whether it was scanned in, but it was a guy stood there with geometrical shapes in the sky.
That was. Those were the first ones. They were the final ink drawings. And then after I turned it digital. Once someone said, I like this. There was one of a man walking in the forest with these sort of floating books above him.
Still
sort of
really
geometric.
Love that one.
I remember that, yeah. It helped me understand where we were with the game.
I think it was interesting because it really was... I mean, I found it interesting to talk to both of you at the same time as producing this work because it sort of was a nice feedback loop of me asking, what's this about? And then me trying to sort of define that. And then as I defined it, you guys were both like, oh no, this is good, this is, you know, we're not feeling it. But mostly all of the reactions were positive. And then I decided on a color palette that was quite limited, just because I like working in limited palettes anyway. And there was some work by a artist called Carl Otto Chechner. I'm ruining his surname. Anyway, he did a very nice 16-image illustration book for the German library, or someone from the German sort of Congress hired him to do this children's illustrated version of Siegfried or the Ring's Nibelung or one of these sagas. And that very quickly became my template of being like, well, I'll produce 16 images that'll let me understand the world and I can sort of test out how sci-fi it is or how fantasy it is or how mystic it is or, you know, abstract, all those different things. So that became a format that was a good decision, I think, because it was limited, because it was 16 images in this very limited color palette. And it sort of was a homage to him, but it gave me enough room temporally in time to develop what I thought the world might be like, yeah.
Because you know, what's interesting about the project is that in order to have, you know, to put in the application and pitch the idea to the young people, we had to have something. But the whole nature of the project is that it's only defined through the process of working with the young people. So it was like we could have this beginning bit. So the same that you have this idea of your 16 images, and maybe you'll talk a little bit more about them, what they are in the end, but you know, you had that kind of goal. We had this kind of starting idea of a goal, and have always tried to kind of not not overthink it beyond that point. And I mean, so when you're asking me, or Tom's asking me, or I'm asking Tom, or I didn't really know either. So when Tom says it helped him figure out, your pictures helped him figure out where we were, it was the same for me, absolutely. I mean, just to have these visuals was fantastic. And I mean, one thing to say is that I thought was amazing was that we were able to just backseat drive and kind of say, no, do this, change that, a bit more of this, a bit more of that. So that feedback loop that you're talking about, you know, I just think that the three of us, that discussion that we had with you chucking up the artwork was just incredible.
It was a really it was a really creative time, actually. It was quite inspiring to be like, wow, we're going to have all this amazing artwork, and I feel like I can already share about it, and having something to put, I mean, I'm sure maybe it's just me that thinks about this, but having something to share on social media where you're like, yeah, we've got this project, it's going to happen, we've got funding for it, and here's some artwork, like, that was just so like exciting to be part of, and actually to have like tiny feedbacks that you might say something and then Max would incorporate it into it. And but having said that, so much of it was about just setting the tone. And Max, you did that. You found that tone, because in a way, me and Barney would talk about it, but we talked. Maybe it's my angle. I'm quite a practical-minded person. I think I kind of like, I try to be like, okay, so what's the scope of their adventures? What are we going to get these young people to do? How much is it? And I'm thinking of all this. And Barney's telling me, oh, but you can go through the world, multiverse. It can be anything. And I'm like, and so that doesn't mean anything to me until I start seeing these pictures. And I'm like, ah, okay. So it's got this limited color palette. It's got this, this tone of landscapes, of a horizon. And it's so interesting because I'm now seeing that from the kids in our games. Like the game I just had, they were in a massive desert at one point, and it was about seeing something really small, a black dot in the background. And we had to walk across this desert to get there. And I was just thinking, this is the images. I can see this as an image that Max has already made. I mean, you haven't actually made that image, but you know what I'm saying? Like the scale was correct. And it fitted the tone that we kind of set with those pictures. A kind of narrative tone. There's lots of different ways you could talk about tone. But like in this, visual language.
I think I was brought on definitely, feeling like I'd be doing some artwork maybe, but not knowing any more than that. And then I think probably the same with you, Tom, but I'm not sure. But what's interesting is, so I sort of felt like I was stepping into the dark, not knowing what to expect. And then when I ever asked Barney stuff, I was like, well, where are we going? You know, you're in Moria, he's Gandalf, right? He's got the little light on his stick. And I'm like, well, where are we going? And he's like, no. I also don't know. Like I'm also wandering in the dark. And I think that gives you as a group permission to be like, well, now anything could be in the dark. And I think that produces lots of nice opportunities. So while you guys felt like, oh, we can be really sneaky here and we can put in, we can tell Max what to draw and we can tell him to put more smoke in it, all those things, I sort of realized that you guys were getting a lot out of the images. And I suddenly started to think, oh, if I just started putting in a lot of like orangerics or like people wearing, shamanistic masks, this is probably going to get stuck in their heads and they'll just put it in the campaign. I can do some backseat game designing from here. That was the good sort of.
Definitely the case. Definitely. And I'm sure that we will get that influence back, as I say, through the JCs as they take over.
This discussion that we had, of course it all was kind of pinned on you giving us more artwork, Max, which was brilliant. But interspersed in all of that was also this dialogue, this text, it would take ages to read it. And I think that the discussion was also really good. And I think that also helped us scope out what we were doing and what we again, this is like Tom was just saying, you know, that kind of visual language. We were talking about the world. We were at this place of potential. And I think maybe, I don't know if people say this enough, I don't know, but role-playing games kind of are like a visual language. You know, you're talking images all of the time, you're talking actions, you're talking descriptions of things. So I think one aspect why visuals are so important in games and around games, but also how we tune into them and what we use them for.
Yeah,
no, I think that's right. And I think, oh no, you go, Tom, you go.
I was going to say, yeah, like, I think tuning in is correct. I think it's like what seeing, you know, Max's style for this project. I mean, I don't think it's his style universally, but like there might be a part of it. There's definitely a part of it that's in there. But, you know, and obviously that's related to Max's relationship with games and fantasy and what things that he sees in his head when he imagines a fantasy landscape with a dragon attacking a castle. You know, that's maybe completely different to what I might see. But me seeing his images, I can't render mine. I can't render mine to a point that I can then make my descriptions or my world building fit the tone that he's kind of established. So it's about tuning in. I like that idea of tuning in. So we're tuning in between our both descriptive and visual abilities.
For me, one of the things I wanted from the pictures was that there's sort of an established aesthetic in my mind of what you might lean on. If you brought a game book and it had dragons in it, but you didn't come with any illustrations, you might immediately lean on the previous sorts of things you'd seen with dragons in it, you know, like Tolkien or Game of Thrones or Dungeons and Dragons or any of those things. They might be an immediate go-to, because obviously when you're describing a fictional environment or species or animal or weapon or whatever, you need a sort of visual reference. So you would immediately be like, well, what do I think a dragon looks like? And then you will draw from your library of them. And so I was very aware with these images, I wanted to produce sort of a antidote to those other images, a sort of antithesis, you know, like just a different alternative. So if you were thinking you were going to just get some Dungeons and Dragons, I was hoping to be like, well, no, it could be this if you want. Like, this is the other side of the spectrum. So it was, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that happened actually in a way that happened in a session. Not really. Like, his session, the dragon that Siegfried, what did you say?
There's two. Siegfried is the German. Sigurd is more Norse, I think.
So it's the German, Siegfried. Siegfried fighting the dragon. The dragon was, he described it though specifically as a Western dragon or as a classical dragon, because he had, I mean, I could say that the artwork meant to him that he had to make sure that he was being clear about his definition. Although he did also cover it in like sci-fi armor, which is great. That's brilliant. Like,
I mean, yeah.
An armored dragon with like big glowing kind of sci-fi armor on. Which, you know, I think that all that stuff comes from the art. Like, we are being out there in our, you know, we have this melding pot of worlds and being able to say, oh yeah, you're in a medieval environment, but it's a city that looks like it's got old cars in it. I've got 19th century buildings among volcanic landscapes or whatever.
Just as a little side note, something from my game today, I borrowed, so the young people are now running the games, so we become players. And for this group, they've let me take on their characters so far. Well, you know, I took on one character and I hit zero balance. So in the mechanics of the game, that means the trickster gets to do something. So I was just attacking a troll and I just wounded it and got to zero. So this wolf that had kind of been helping us and following us turned into like a dark mist and it kind of shot this dark mist at the troll, and it took the wound turned into a dimensional tear, and then these little tiny demons jumped out. So it was some kind of hell place. So there are these little demons, and they were horrible little creatures. So that was really exciting. And we had a character collapse. I revived him. So
wow,
that was quite good fun. Anyway, Max, could you tell us a little bit more about those 16 images and how you arrived at them and what they may be
mean or what are they? I've got a practical answer and then I've got a more sort of metaphorical answer. So the practical thing is I did the first one, which was a sort of island looking thing sort of poking out of the sea with a sort of geometric shape above it, and I sent that to you guys and you were like, oh, we like it, and I wanted to try it with a few colours, and that's how I got into using the colour palette. And I sort of finished that one, and I didn't have any idea what it was. I just had this image sort of in my mind of an object coming out of the sea that could be maybe the prow of a submarine or maybe an island with these sort of birds around it and this geometric shape. And then I think Tom was like, put a little guy on it for scale, or someone said that, and I did it. And then from there, I figured out what I wanted the 16 images to be, which is sort of a backstory for what I see to be the previous sort of trickstery event. That's how I've justified it to myself in order to draw them. Was like, this has happened before, and here's sort of, like at the beginning, in some Zelda games, you see this sort of carved on the stone wall is the ancient prophecy of what came before. And I saw these sort of as the renderings of someone in the world, like an artist resident of the Trickster's Net universe, drawing the thing that came before. So it's not necessarily accurate to how the Trickster looks or how the world is. It's sort of, it's through all these lenses, it's through the lens of the world itself. So that was my goal with them, was to produce a backstory that you could immediately read the images and read several things into them if you were looking for sort of the hidden plate, aeroplanes or tanks or motorways. But if you just viewed them as fantasy images, you would probably just get that back out of them. So yeah, a backstory is how I justified it to myself, and from within the world, as if they'd come out of the trips into our world, like a pamphlet of like, this is what happened last time, it was bad. That's quite brief. I can go deeper into individual ones, but that's kind of a sum up of
my... I mean, that is stunning. That's stunning. But they also fit together, don't they?
Yeah, like a tapestry.
Yeah, they're sequential. Like a big wall tapestry. That would be the dream, would be there being a big castle or a tapestry or carved into a rock face. And they lead one to another, and they're in pairs, so they mirror each other either visually or like thematically, and they get progressively more complicated. And they start very vague, like a big sort of giant cosmic egg in the ocean, sort of almost like a creation myth. They start very vague, coming out of nothingness, and then they become much more literal towards the end.
Super.
Yeah. To describe, I was learning how to describe the language of what I wanted to say about the Trickster's Net anyway. So for me, the big egg in the sea and the island with the geode above it, the geometric shape, I wasn't sure what they were myself. It's like the ideas arrive from this other place, obviously. And the nice thing about the Trickster's Net project is it sort of invited that quality out of everyone, hopefully the players too, that these ideas arise from an unknown place. And then you sort of chase them, and they sort of, you know, they grow. It's very organic.
Yeah.
And I wanted that reflected in the images. I didn't want it to try and force it to be... I liked the vagueness. I wanted the vagueness at the start.
Totally. And they're really inviting. And yeah, I feel like they draw you in, like all good role-playing illustrations do. But yeah, they don't fix things. I can see Tom's been saying he's got to go. So I guess that brings an end to this wonderful conversation for now, but I know we will pick this up again in the future. Thank you so much, Max.
Nice to be here.
And Tom, it's lovely to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you, Max. And thank you, Barney. Yeah, cheers.